The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm going back to South Africa. There is a couple more interviews that I wanted to do that I never had a chance. One place that we visited, one of the most gorgeous wineries. You have to go if you are in Stellenbosch, Anthony Rupert Vineyard. And we are talking to the head winemaker, Davi Bata. Davi, thank you so much for being a part of this.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Let's just start here. How is everything right now in Stellenbosch and in Cape Town when it comes to COVID? And I ask this because when we were there right when the outbreak of Omicron happened, which made flying home a real delight. But I'm just curious how everything is going there right now.
Well, yeah, on the past Monday, the Monday that's just passed, the last protocols were actually got rid of, basically. So you don't have to wear masks anymore. You don't have to show your COVID passport anymore. So everything is pretty much back to normal. Even restaurants and stadiums can go to full capacity now. So we're pretty much over it at the moment. We've got a daily infection rate of under 1,000 for the country. So it was actually very low.
Oh, that's fantastic. How much did it impact you guys in terms of selling of your wine, both globally and within the country?
It set us back internationally a lot. Because we lost all our international market sales because the whole world was in lockdown. And also in South Africa, we had a ban on liquor sales and cigarette sales as well. And so we just bottled less. And this is the first time we actually had to sell bulk wine. First time since I've been on this farm. I've been here for 20 years. And the other thing that also happened was also that the market kind of changed. It was we used to be about 70% on-con and 30% off-con. And that almost changed completely around to almost 70% of our wine sales is online orders, online sales. People are entertaining more home. Restaurants are carrying smaller, more focused wine lists. So the whole tendency has moved towards the entertainment home and private sector, online sector, basically.
So wait a minute. I got to go back. I want to do two things, and then I want to get into the winery and your own journey. But you guys sold, because you couldn't bottle as much, you sold bulk. You had to sell off your wine. Is that the highest quality bulk wine that's ever been sold in South Africa?
No, it is. A lot of people actually did export bulk in export wine in bulk. And we did some of our, from some of the wines that would have gone into some of our, into the Protea range we sold off.
Right.
But none of the other ones we had to sell. We're just slightly behind on vintage and the red, but that's fine.
I just had this image of all this beautiful single vineyard Cab Franc being sold in like a giant vat, and that made me sad for a second.
No, that luckily didn't happen. So all our AR wines and all the Cape of Good Hope wines still bottled, still made from the same quality vines and wines.
When the ban was going on, because I was hearing about this when we were there, how weird was that when there was a ban on alcohol? Some people were talking about it was like prohibition in America, Al Capone, and people selling Pinot in speakeasies.
Yeah, it was a funny time. It was surreal because no alcohol and no tobacco was sold. So it became like the prohibition. Everyone started almost in towns. You can find like a small underground ring where you can actually find some illegal alcohol. So alcohol just went, some of it went underground for the time being.
So let's go back then to you. When you came aboard with Rupert Wine, been there, as you said, since 2005. What was 2005 like for you at that time, personally and professionally?
Well, we were still very young. I think we were still on the fast cars and fast girls phase in our lives. 2005 was the first time we harvested in the gravity cellar. So everything was new. We learned a lot. We are still learning a lot. And also our vineyards are much older now. So the young vineyards, we grew up with them. I think it was a nice journey to actually get to grow up with your vineyards as well. And we've acquired some other vineyards along the road. Now, if you look at 2005 compared to 2022, the vines are older. We are older. Your wine style is more settled down, and we're still making the great quality wines. We have downtoned the oak a little bit. We fine-tuned our structure. So we're still learning. We're still growing every year.
It's interesting. You mentioned that twice at the beginning and the end of the interview that you're still learning. And a lot of these vines you've been with for 17 years. How challenging, but also how much do you enjoy the fact that you're always learning?
Well, yeah, you're never going to stop learning because it's a natural product, and you're always kind of subjected to weather conditions, to microclimate conditions, and even world conditions with COVID and wars going on and getting stock, and so there's a lot of factors that's out of your control. And every year to actually compensate for those different factors every year, that's where the experience comes in. Different vintages, dry vintages, wet vintages, not be able to get your barrels on time because of shipping routes that's out of sync. There's a lot of factors that always differs every year that you have to compensate for.
I'm curious about vine age. When you mention that, in Ontario, I've discovered over the last 10 years, the quality of the red wines consistently have gone up so much. And I think a lot of that is just the boring answer of time. Vines get older and people get smarter. I'm curious, Davi, just what is the impact for you and for your wines? Just the simple fact that the vines themselves are that much older. How much does that impact the quality of your wines?
Well, firstly, you have a lot more concentration because usually if you have your younger vineyards, it's a lot more upfront fruit, the older vines, you have more structure, more concentration. So even if you take just the small differences, if you get a young vine, you have to look at the trellising, you have to look at leaf plucking, you have to look at the growth. But if you take an old vine, because we classify an old vines in Africa as 35 years and older. You know, the old vines, they start growing when they have to. The shoot growth stop when they have to. They carry just enough bunches, then they can ripen. So, you know, also the vine has got wiser as well. So, and in the end, it's up to the winemaker to listen to the vine.
It's it is fascinating to me just when you try an old vine wine versus new vine and just the difference. Let's go to you for a second. How did you, as you said, you started there at Anthony Rupert back in 2005. But what about your own journey into wine? What made you fall in love with it?
I grew up on a table grape farm, so I was into vineyards, but I wasn't into any contact with wine making. So when I went to study at the University of Stellenbosch, I went to study BSc Agriculture with my main subject being viticulture and oenology. So, but you had to have oenology to be able to take viticulture. And so while studying, we got to meet wine. And then you also had to start working in a winery. You had to work in a winery to gain experience, part of your degree, and do a little thesis on that as well. So that's how I got into the wine side, and you know, in the end, the wine side tickled me more than the grape side. And after studying, I did a little internship at Chateau Angelus in France, and then I also worked a little bit in Mendocino at Bonterra Vineyards, and that's not that far from you guys. And then I started in South Africa. I started in at Leopard's Leap, and before I started, I moved over to Anthony Rupert Wines.
What are the biggest differences in terms of making wine from your experience, France versus California versus South Africa?
I would say that the winemaking process is more or less everywhere. It's the same everywhere in the world. But if you look closer to the attention to details, the biggest differences is vineyard practices. And also that small little differences in the winery. I always say there's a couple of important choices you have to make when you make wine is the day you decide to pick the vineyard, that's one of your most important things. If it's green, overripe, or just perfect, if you want to pick for red fruit or ripe fruit, that's a choice or stylistic choice you have to make. And then also your time on skins. If you do cold soaking beforehand, maceration, if you do how long your maceration is afterwards, and then also your barrel selection also makes a huge impact on your ageability and your aging of your wine. I think the process itself is more or less the same, but how people actually apply the process around the world varies a lot.
If France has all the laws and rules, and California, you can kind of do what you want, where does South Africa fit in that in terms of regulations of what you can and can't do in the vineyard and in the winery?
Well, we also have a very strict system. It's called SAVAS. It's implemented. You can only do certain wines. Everything needs to be certified. Certain percentages in your blends you can do and cannot do. But we can decide on our own picking dates. We can decide on our own blends that we want to do. So I know in France, they're strict almost to the point where they tell you when you can start to harvest, what areas you can plant what. But they are busy changing that. But yeah, we have got a strict controlling system. But if it comes to picking dates and blendings, we're pretty open.
Would you say, I'm always curious about this, Davi, how stressful is it the night before when you've decided you know when you're going to harvest?
I didn't say it's stressful. It's more of anticipation because harvest is fun.
In terms of picking the right date, have you ever, you know, leading up to it, is there ever that moment of nervousness of I better make sure this is the right date?
Always when you pick your first vineyard, you're kind of a little bit out of practice from the last vintage. So I tend to always pick the first little batch, maybe 2 or 3 days early. But then after your second, third batch, you actually catch up. I always say if you pick, no matter how many batches that you pick or vineyards that you pick, if you can get it 90% perfect, then you had a job well done, basically.
Let's go back to 2012. I think that's when you became the head winemaker over there. I'm wondering just for yourself personally, how did that feel?
Well, it's always nice to step up or to move to the next phase in your life. But we are a great team in the different wineries, so it didn't feel really different. I just started fulfilling a new role within the team. But we're still the same, more or less the same team. So, and it's always... It's not about the person, it's about the team you have. It's always been about teamwork for us.
Well, I'm curious a little bit about the winery itself, about Rupert, in terms of the history of it. I know there's certainly some tragedy as well. I was wondering for the listeners if you could tell them a little bit about the winery.
Antoine Rupert Wines used to be called Lormerat. The Lormerat farm was actually the first owner of Lormerat was one of the French Huguenots that were persecuted from France, and they fled to South Africa. So they were all basically situated in Franschhoek, that is called today, which basically means French Corner. And before that, it was called Elephant's Corner or Elephant's Hook. So after that, the Rupert's is after Jean Rat. Jean Rat was the first French owner. He named the farm Lormerat after his hometown in France. So then years later, the Rupert's bought the property. So they're now the fourth owner since the French Huguenots of this property. And then Antoine Rupert, Johann Rupert's brother, he was the owner of this property. And he actually studied winemaking in Geisenheim in Germany back in the days. So yeah, he had wine background or was trained in wine. And then there was only one winery on the property called the Lormerat Winery. And he unfortunately passed away in 2001. And after 2001... Basically, in 2002, Johann Rupert took over the farm from his late brother. And then he added the gravity-fed boutique winery and also the underground barrel storage areas and rebuilt the farm extensively. And also one of the most important things he did was we replanted most of our vineyards to where the good soils are more up on your upper slopes. We've got predominantly decomposed granite soils. And so we moved the vineyards. That's why the vineyards is now getting older and into their own. It's now giving us this insane quality what you're getting on the wines nowadays. And also In 2005, we renamed the farm, but we renamed the product from Lormora. We renamed it to Anthony Rupert Wines. The reason for that was just to keep Anthony Rupert's name alive.
And yeah, that is, I mean, just sad passing away so young back in 2001. What is the importance of the mountain vineyards when it comes to quality?
I think especially for us, because in every valley, you've got your valley floor that's just basically sand and river stones, which is not really optimal for vineyards. But if you move to your foothills, especially in Franschhoek, you get this nice decomposed granite soils. And too high up in the mountains, that's your primary granite. What that gives us is just granite soils gives you a nice natural dark fruit component on your reds. And also it keeps its water for longer. And if you move up the mountains, slopes, also your aspect starts playing a role. Your sunrise, sunset, wind factors, height above sea level, all starts to come into play as well.
Yeah, it's funny. No, I was in Moselle just recently, and it's a lot of it, such a different region, but still the same thing. Be on the side of the hill, be on that slope, get more of that sun. It doesn't matter where you are. It seems same thing like in Burgundy. That's always the source of usually for the wines that can have the most depth and power to them.
So, yeah, if you talk about sunlight, it's usually mostly for red wine varietals. They want more of the afternoon sun, and your white wine varietals want more of your morning sun and not sun in the afternoon. So you've got your cooler slope and your warmer slope.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. What you want for Cabernet is not what you want for Riesling. Doing my reading, what did you guys do in the vineyards in terms of protecting the wind? Because when we were there in Cape Town in Stellenbosch, we were there during the last part of the crazy wind season, which seems great for kites, but maybe not great for wine production.
Yeah, it's your road direction is very important. So sometimes with your normal trellis system, sometimes you have to compensate your morning and afternoon sun side. You have to actually compensate your road direction for wind, because if you put it square into the wind, you're going to actually create it like a wind sail effect, and you get more damage. But also we've moved towards staked vines, or échalas, as they call it in the French word. Afrikaans, they call it stok by palkie. So it doesn't have any wires anymore. It's just every vine's got its own stake. So no matter from what aspect, from what side you look in, the wind can always blow through it. So there's no trellising system that creates a natural wind sail. So that's right. That's what we're planting on the hills. That's not protected against the wind. We'll do staked vines.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, it will blow you over, especially mm-hmm. the higher up you go. It is powerful. It's something that I think a lot of people don't think of when they think of problems for vineyards. Usually it's disease, bugs, hail, frost at the wrong time. But the wind there, it is a powerful thing. You almost have to experience to truly believe.
Yeah, it's called the Southeaster. Mm-hmm. It's a damaging wind.
Yeah, absolutely. Getting off winemaking, I'm curious about scores. I read that your Rupert 2007 blend at the time got 95 points, which was the highest score ever for a South African Cabernet blend in Wine Spectator. And I'm wondering, especially maybe more then than now, how important is it to get those scores? Not for you. I mean, you guys make fantastic wines, but just to try to get the message out there to people about the quality of what you guys do.
Well, I think if you look at the scoring system, you have to break it down, because you have to decide what you want to use competition for or scoring for. Do you want to use it for a sticker on a bottle? Do you want to use it for more visibility? So it's like Wine Spectator. If you have serious wines you want to sell in the US, you have to be 90 plus in Wine Spectator. That's one of the main reasons. Otherwise, they will not take you seriously. So that's why we entered into the Wine Spectator, to get that 90 plus scores, to be able to sell your wines for $100 a bottle in the US.
Actually, let's go for that for a second. I've said this before, that South African Cabernet is a great alternative for people who can't afford the crazy prices for, say, Napa Cabernet. And I'm wondering, where do your wines sell best in the world?
At the moment, after COVID, our wine sells best in the world pretty much in South Africa. Mm-hmm. But we do export to the US. I think we're selling slightly more in Canada than the US at the moment. And we do distribute in Europe. And the other one is UK. We're doing slight inroads into the East, but not a lot. And also our top-end wines, the volume is sometimes also a breaking factor because we don't have that vast volume. So we try to focus more on quality than quantity.
Is it because just the land prices are less expensive? I'm always curious about this. A $20 South African cab or cab blend, the quality is far higher than that same $20 in Napa. I opened up a $55 bottle of Stellenbosch cab the other day, and it easily was as good as any $100, $115 bottle. How much of that is just it's less expensive to make wine where you are?
It might be slightly less expensive, but I think the biggest factor with that pricing range is the export cost and the taxes and the import cost, and to go through all the hoops, basically, there's a lot of cost that gets added onto it. So I would almost say we look at 40 to 50% of the cost is basically just to get the wine there.
Oh, that just annoys. How important is Cabernet, either in Sauvignon or Franc, in the South African red wine industry? Because I'll tell you, Davi, when we went over there to travel, when I thought of South Africa, I thought of Syrah, Chenin Blanc, Cab Classique. And it was the cabs that really opened my eyes when I was there.
Yeah, we've got your areas. So if you look at Swartland, it's your classic Shiraz and Chenin Blanc area, and Stellenbosch, Somerset West is more your Cab Sav area. Franschhoek is more your Cab Franc area. Paul is Shiraz and Cab Sav. But the most planted red varietal in Africa is Merlot at the moment. And so Merlot, then Cab and Cab Franc. So that's your top three. And Shiraz is also, that's basically your top four planted varietals. Because we still, I think a lot of people is experimenting with new varietals in South Africa at the moment. It's just sometimes difficult to get plant material. But before isolation, we only had almost your top classics basically that were planted in South Africa.
You mentioned Merlot. Are you the chairman of the Merlot Forum?
Yes.
So yes. Tell people about Merlot, because years ago that movie Sideways came out and Pinot Noir suddenly became the only thing people bought, and then everyone just started shitting on Merlot. It's totally not fair. Tell people just what Merlot brings to your wines.
Well, if you look at South African wines, Merlot actually sells very well. Because I think in most people's mind, if you think Merlot, they think soft tannins, they think nice red fruit, they think a good mouthfeel. That's what in general people stigmatize Merlot under. Whereas people will think of a cab, they'll think full-bodied. If it's more on the cheaper side, they might think it's astringent. But we do a single varietal Merlot that we're very proud of. It's very important when you do Merlot to get your concentration right, your picking date, because sometimes you can struggle with concentration and the fruit profile on Merlot. It works great in blends. I've always had Cab Merlot blends, Cab from Merlot blends. Just helps to flesh out the fruit profile and soften up your mid palate and the finish as well.
I wanted to tell people just a little bit about the profile of the wines. We were there. We got to try, just such a wide range of the Rupert wines. So I want to know, for listeners who don't know, what they can expect.
Just to run you through the different wines that we do under Antoine Rupert wines is we've got our flagship range. It's predominantly our red single varietals and our red blends. So we've got a Merlot, a Cab Sav, and a Cab Franc, straight separately bottled, limited. And we also have a estate blend that we do in that range. And then we've got our bigger blend, Bordeaux-style blend. It's called the Optima. That's one of our more well-known red blends. And then we've got the Cape of Good Hope range that is predominantly or mainly our single varietals. If we have a batch or a vineyard or a parcel that is something unique, something special, we'll keep it separate, we'll bottle it separate to showcase it as an individual terroir-driven wine. That's where we have Sauvignon Blanc, Chenin Blanc, some of our Chardonnay. We've got our Shiraz, our Swartland Shiraz in there as well. And we've got the Pinot Noir, we've got the Sneeuwkrantz Pinot Noir in there. And then we have our Terra del Capo range, which is our Italian grape varietals. So we do some Pinot Gris and some Sangiovese as well.
Really?
So we keep under a separate label. That basically stems from Antoni Rupert used to love his Italian wines, his Tuscans. And so he, back in the days, he brought in Pinot Grigio and Sangiovese plant material, and we've been doing it ever since. So I really like those wines. And then under, and then with that, we also have our Protea range. Or before that, we've got our Lormora range, where our Cup Classics are under, and we do a port, or we call it the late bottled vintage that we do. And then also we've got our Protea range with that pattern, that design on the bottle that we want people to reuse the bottle or upcycle. It's a word for that.
How much fun is it playing with a grape like Sangiovese, which you don't probably normally get to do on a day-to-day basis?
It's a lot of fun. I know sometimes if you've got your main varietals to play with, but it's always nice to have that younger child in the stable that gets some extra attention as well.
By the way, for anyone listening in Southern Ontario, you can get Optima, I believe the wine consignment company, A Case for Wine. I saw it there the other day prepping for this interview. So if you're looking to try something immediately from Rupert, I would go to A Case for Wine. You can certainly find it there. Or drop me a line, DM me on Twitter, and I can try to help you out as well. What's next for you, Davi? Like, you know, again, you've been here since 2005. I mean, you're only a couple of years away from your 20th anniversary. What's next for you in this winery?
Well, it's a continuous building process, because everyone wants to make that perfect wine. And
how close have you come? Sorry to interrupt. What is the closest? What is the vintage? What is the wine that's the closest? Because I know you'll never say 100% perfect, but what's the closest you've come to perfection?
Well, if it comes to perfect vintages, I'll say 12 was pretty much right up there. I think what we have in the cellar at the moment will, I'll say, 18. But the one that really, stood out for me as well was 15 as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we always strive for the perfect wine. Sometimes you get close, or sometimes you think you've made it, but you've made the perfect wine, but the wine writer or the wine scores one don't think that way, the same way as you do. But that's ongoing. But also, stylistically, we want to also, what we're trying to do is if you make a, let's say, take a single varietal, a Merlot that we do, you want to start off with a style that you want to focus on. And every year you just want to fine tune and make the style better. But if you do a vertical of 10 vintages next to each other, you must always have that golden thread stylistically in the wine. So you don't want it to taste like this year or like that next year, but you always want to make it slightly better than the previous year. Always try to tweak it, but minutely. So I always say a wine style almost directly follows lifestyle as well. So that's always changing continuously.
What's the moment, and we only have a couple minutes left, I'm curious, Davi, is there a moment when you realize, okay, I've got a special wine on my hands? Is it early in the fermentation process? Is it early before that when you're tasting the grapes? Is there a moment when you can tell, I got something special going on here?
Usually you can see a glimpse of it in the grapes, in the size of the berry, the vineyard, when you get at the sorting tables. Usually you can actually start getting a glimpse after fermentation, if you did after maceration. But the first glimpse you really get is after malolactic, after your first racking. It's about 2 months after that. Mm-hmm. Then you can actually start picking up, wow, this is something, yeah, we've got something special. So we usually start, that's almost this time for us now, in the next month or two, we'll start tasting through the barrels. And just to slightly almost start roughly sorting out your different batches into quality groups, basically. And then continuously from there for the next year and a half, we'll still taste them. So we keep all our batches, all our vineyards, if we have separate pickings in the vineyards, even the free run, the press, we'll age separately for about 16 months before we do our final blends. So you still have all those different building blocks you can actually choose from. And sometimes they'll change after 12 months. Sometimes they change for the good. Sometimes they change for the worse. But that's why I keep them all separate, to always have that options to play around with in the end.
Last question. Why should people come and visit you, visit Rupert and Stellenbosch? I can rave about it, but I was only there for 2 weeks.
Well, as you know, it's a very stressful environment to be on this farm. No, just joking. No, we always encourage people or always invite people to come and visit us. We always, the more people visiting us, the better. We like to entertain people. We do sell it to us. We've got a motor museum, a classic motor museum on the farm as well. We've got two different tasting rooms. We've got a little tapas restaurant as well. And we've got massive open spaces, so big lawns, big trees, and yeah, and friendly staff, professional, and come and taste our wines. And we'd like to hear your opinion as well. It's always nice to have a original opinion from different countries.
It is a gorgeous place. We got the full tour and the, you know, and just from the vineyards and the wineries and just up high on top of your buildings overlooking all of Stellenbosch. It was breathtaking. Actually, I got a second here left. What you mentioned, you're just racking now. How's 2022? How's this vintage looking?
22 is looking, it's starting to turn out all right. I think it was a very uneven vintage for red wines. We had rain and heat waves all in the same week for a couple of weeks in a row. So we had a lot of unevenness in the vineyard. But luckily, we've got optical sorting when we do an intake of our berries. And I think that helped a lot to get rid of most of that uneven berries. But it's shaping up to be quite a good year. And it's still too early to say. But we've got nice color. We've got nice richness. And we'll see how the wood interacts with the wines in a couple of months. We'll start looking at that aspect as well.
Davi, really appreciate you taking the time to join me on the podcast today. We were huge fans of the visit, huge fans of the wines. And again, for people listening, if you want that full-bodied Cabernet thing that you like, but you can't afford some of the high-end, way overpriced California. South Africa is an incredible source for wines, and your vineyard is certainly one that represents your country really well. So I really appreciate you taking time to join me today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.